WUSB, Stony Brook, 90.1 FM. And welcome to this edition of the Healthy Planet radio program. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for the best hour of your life, the one that's always in front of you, right now. The Healthy Planet focuses on topics that will help to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth and the powerful effects your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world, which is what we all want. Well, in the blink of an eye, the coronavirus is out of the news, even though the story is far from over, and we'll cover that in future months. The massive nationwide and even global protests following the murder of George Floyd by several police officers is now front and center. Our guest on today's show is an important voice in our government today. He's someone who has experienced both sides of the police brutality and racism issues. He was the victim of police violence and subsequently served for many years as a New York City police officer. His name is Eric Adams, and as many of you know, he's the Brooklyn Borough President. To put the importance of that job into perspective, for those of you who don't already know, if Brooklyn was a city unto itself, it would be the third largest city in the United States. In addition to his important perspective on the issues that are currently rocking our nation, he's a tailor-made guest for our show for other reasons as well. Since, as you'll hear, he's a vocal proponent of healthy eating and a whole foods plant-based diet, a vegan diet, after facing a very serious health threat himself. Eric Adams was born in Brownsville, Brooklyn, to Father Leroy, a butcher, and Mother Dorothy, a house cleaner and cook. He graduated from the police academy as the highest-ranked student in his class and went on to serve in the New York City Police Department for 22 years, having attained the rank of captain when he retired in 2006. During his time with the NYPD, he often spoke out against police brutality and racial profiling, and he co-founded 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement Who Care, an advocacy group for Black police officers. In 2006, he made a successful run for the New York State Senate, where he served four terms. He worked on issues including affordable housing, educational funding, and preventative medicine. He became a champion on statewide matters, such as good government, workers' rights, quality of life concerns, and public safety. Eric Adams effectively organized support against the NYPD's controversial Stop, Question, and Frisk policy, and on behalf of gun control. In 2013, he was elected by Brooklynites to be the first African-American to serve as Brooklyn Borough President. Eric Adams, welcome to The Healthy Planet.
Thank you. Thank you.
I know that with the George Floyd protests happening nationwide and in Brooklyn, your voice and your wisdom are very, very much in demand right now. And that's something I'm really happy about. And I also want to thank you very much for making the time to join us at a time when you are being pulled in so many directions.
Thank you so much for having this great conversation.
All right. Now, our nonprofit organization has been involved in health and environmental education going back to 1990. And for all these years, we've known that the message of a healthful plant-based diet was incredibly powerful and potentially transformative if enough people learned about it. And that impacts everything from the healthcare system, potentially saving us hundreds of billions of dollars every year just in preventative medicine, preventing diseases that need not be. Of course, addressing the world hunger issue in a very powerful way. And of course, the impact it has on the animals. And of course, the impact it has on our social structure in cutting out all the violence that is behind the scenes, whether we like it or not, as the result of our diet. And over all these years, we knew that eventually some high-profile personalities would be joining this movement because it just made too much sense on too many levels and there was no downside. And 30 years later, here you are, one of those high-profile personalities that we've been waiting for, with the power to have an impact on millions and perhaps many more than that. So I know that what initially opened your eyes to the power of a whole food plant-based diet was actually connected to the losing of your actual eyesight. Talk a little bit about that transformation, how it began.
First of all, thank you. And I love the fact that you use the term healthy planet because we are so connected. And healthy planet doesn't mean that only health to the people who are on the planet, but is really in order to have a healthy planet of all of us are going to have to be healthy. That includes the animals, that includes the plant life, our atmosphere. And it is really why we must all take a close look at what we're doing. And so my journey started about 4 years ago when I was experiencing late stages of diabetes that I was not aware of. I thought it was I was having a problem in my stomach. I thought it was actually colon cancer. And when I went to the doctor, he did a check of my colon and my stomach and told me I had a small ulcer. But he said my real crisis was my diabetes. And at that time, it was in late stages with a high A1C reading. I was also experiencing late stage symptoms such as vision loss, as you indicated, in my left eye. The doctor, my ophthalmologist, actually told me I was legally blind and I had to turn in my driver's license. And I was having permanent nerve damage in my hands and feet. They were tingling really badly at the time. And because of that, I thought I was going to be on medicine the rest of my life, and just to learn that there were other pathways to deal with health.
There are so many people in that condition and so much money and so much suffering as a result of them not knowing what you learned, because when you went through this, your doctors did not tell you that there was a way of reversing this, that there was a way of changing this. They just told you that you needed to be on medication.
And that's very interesting, because when I went into the doctors, and I have a very kind, loving doctor. So, you know, when you look at these problems, it's not so much the doctor's fault. The real betrayal is the patients as well as the healthcare professionals, who I believe is experiencing PTSD from the number of cases that they're seeing people go on this spiraling decline, medical decline. But I went to 5 of the best doctors in the city, and they all told me the same thing, that Eric, it's hereditary, you're going to be on medicine the rest of your life. I walked into my doctor's office that day to check my colon, and I walked out with medicine for my eyes, 3 or 4 medicines, including insulin for my diabetes, one for my high blood pressure, another for my high cholesterol, another for the ulcer. I walked in with no medicine and walked out with a bag of medicine. I became my own personal Dwayne Reed by the time I walked out. And you know what was really fascinating? That they gave me pamphlets that said, living with diabetes. And when I did something I like to say was scientific, I went to the computer and typed reversing diabetes. And that one change of road switched the entire road that I went down. And I found a lot of information about reversing diseases.
Yep, that one word. To let people know, I mentioned that a lot of people have diabetes. Your case is not unique. And your case in being able to reverse diabetes is not unique. It's just that we don't know it. And I appreciate the distinction you made about the doctors, because I do not blame the doctors at all. It's the training that they got and the direction that they go in once they come out of medical school. And that requires a change on all levels. It requires a change in our desire to have that. And so the people who are going to doctors need to ask for that. And at the same time, the medical schools need to implement training that serves humans and serves to change our health and increase our health rather than just treating our diseases.
That is so true. And the doctors that I went to see, one in particular, I recall reading the information and I was saying to myself, what is this? You know, it was unbelievable. And I started reading different lectures and information from Dr. Barnard, Dr. Greger, and Dr. Esselton. I actually called and I took a flight to Ohio, the Cleveland Clinic, to see him. And, you know, it was fascinating when he was telling me that it's possible to reverse your chronic disease by eating a plant-based diet. I remember saying, what is wrong with this nut? I'm going blind. He's telling me to stop eating steak. And when I returned to the city and I looked in my fridge and my pantry and started reading the labels, I realized that I was not eating food. I was eating food-like stuff. Everything was processed. Yeah. And I threw it away and went to a whole food plant-based diet. And within 3 weeks, my vision came back. Yeah. And within 3 months, all the nerve damage went away. My diabetes went in remission. My cholesterol normalized. My blood pressure normalized. Everything just changed. I dropped 35 pounds and never looked back and felt great ever since.
Yeah, that's very powerful. And it is. Most people who go in this direction never look back. And that's so an important thing to consider for those of you who are listening to the show and think, well, I could try it for a while. But when you start seeing results, you start reading more about the implications, some of which we'll talk about in the next few minutes, of your diet, then it's very compelling and it lasts. It's a good way of changing. It's not a forced change.
And it's not, you know, what's fascinating, it's not unique to me because my mother is 80 years old and she was diabetic for 15 years, on insulin for 7 years. She was on 9 medications. And mom, you know, called me and said, you know, son, I'm really tired of having all of these medications and this pain all the time. And she went whole food plant-based and within 2 months, she was off her insulin. Think about that. 80 years old.
Yeah, that's great to hear.
It is.
That's really nice to hear. I'll mention my own parents' story. I've got parents. My mother is 90. My father's 95. Wow. And they credit their health and their longevity and their healthfulness to the work that I've been doing with my nonprofit. Mm-hmm. They've come to see our speakers over the course of many decades. They've listened to the radio shows over the course of decades. And they're models now, you know, they're really great. And that makes me feel like, you know, all my work is worth it, regardless of what else comes from it.
Right. So true. So true. Yeah. And it's important to, you know, all of my families. I have 5 siblings and each one of them are experiencing chronic disease from the range of cancer to kidney failure. And all of us, no matter who we are, no matter what block we live on, our economic status or our ethnicity or lifestyle, we all know someone that is going through a chronic disease. And our healthcare system is not sustainable. When you really think about it, 84 million pre-diabetics, 30 million diabetics, and the money we're spending, 80 cents on a dollar, for dealing with chronic diseases. It's unsustainable to think we can get around this. And that's why we must do something new and understand how to do it correctly.
Yep, we have a healthcare crisis. It's just different than what most people think it is.
So true, so true. Yeah. That was very disappointing with the presidential elections that's taking place in a debate. Everyone talked about access to healthcare. No one talked about how do we prevent people from having to have that access in the first place. Of course, we want great facilities if we were to get sick, but I don't want a fancy hospital just to tell me I'm going to lose my sight or I'm going to lose my limbs or I'm going to have another stent. There's no pleasure in that. We need to go beyond that. And I really believe that we're starting to move in that direction.
We are. We are. And these conversations and your presence in the position that you're in makes it all the more possible that that is going to happen in the nearer term. So I believe so. Keep on that. So switching up the topic, we humans thus far have made the assumption that we're the cream of the crop. Above all other animals, And that's partially based upon the fact that we have the ability to build things. We drive cars. We make big buildings. You know, we've got all this technology behind us. And we're smart and we can write and we can have computers. And so we're able to dominate everything else on the planet to some degree until it backfires on us, which is what's happening with the COVID-19. It's also partially because we have religion that says that we are at the top of the hierarchy when it comes to all life on Earth. And in fact, some religions even suggest that we're not animals, which is an interesting topic right there. But so as a result of that perspective, we've gotten on to really do pretty much what we want to other species on this planet. Now, you've always been somewhat sensitive to the well-being of animals, I know, because I've read about you and heard you speak. And so how do you see the relationship between humans and animals? And how has that been affected by your choice to stop eating them? Has that opened any windows for you to actually see the issue for something that you weren't able to see previously?
Without a doubt. That's why I do not look down on people who are not at the same place that I am. I like to meet people where they are and take them where they ought to be. And I know there was an evolution that I had to go through, and I know others are going to go through their evolutions, because a truth is truth. And, you know, I think that I say to myself that I was like a caterpillar crawling on the ground, looked up at a butterfly and said, "You'll never get me in one of those." Little did I know there was a cocoon that would be waiting for me. I am not the person that I was 4 years ago or even 15 years ago. And even not the person that I was last year. Sure. And so I think everyone has an ability to evolve. And we just need to meet them where they are, give them some very clear information. And I was listening to what you were saying about we have dominion over all. I'm sure if the cows were writing their spiritual text, they'll say they had dominion. And the elephants would do the same. So it's easy for man to make that determination. We're the one that's writing the text. It is our story. And so his story and her story is going to define everything through our lens. But the reality is, we're all connected. There was an amazing experiment that was done in Geneva, Switzerland, many years ago, where they divided two pieces of matter in half, and they separated them by 7 miles. And they impacted one piece of matter, and simultaneously, the other piece of matter was impacted. And it shows that it's an amazing experiment that was done in front of many men and women of the media. But it shows our connectivity. You and I cannot do something to each other without it impacting both of us. We are connected. We're part of a universal order, and we can't think that we could destroy the planet without destroying ourselves, or destroy animals without destroying ourselves. As we see, the destruction of not only our mothers are being hurt by what we consume, but Mother Earth is being hurt. Our burning of the Amazon for chicken feed, our overconsumption of meat. Everyone is knowing that, and all the experts are seeing, that's the connection to the destruction of our families and destruction of our health.
Yeah, it's definitely all connected. And if you start out with that understanding, it makes the whole picture easier to understand when you look at things. And that goes with health as well as with the environment. So if you're just trying to heal your elbow and you find an ointment that's going good for your elbow, but it causes cancer, that's not what we're looking for. And if you find something that heals you and it destroys the planet, that's not what we're looking for.
So true.
Yeah, when you act from connection, you get to the answers. Like you, what you said, when you change your search term just a little bit, you came up with entirely different results.
And that's why one of the challenges is that we have to unlearn what we learn so we can finally learn. Mm. There's so much.
Yes.
That we have been taught about our existence that really is in our way of really finding our true purpose. And that's part of the pursuit we must have. It's amazing how much time we spend on those things that are external and not really explore the internal. My son said something to me when I told him I was diabetic. He says, "Dad, I watch you go from service station to service station to put the best gas in your car and the best oil in your car, but you don't put the best food in your body." Mm. You spend a lot of time about all those external things, the beauty of our house, the finest wood inside, the finest dining, the finest suit and clothing to wear. We do all those external things, but we turn over our health to someone else and we take their decisions on how to take care of ourselves. We got to turn that around. Let someone else take care of the house. We need to take care of ourselves.
Yeah, profound. And it's a contradiction of our values, because think about how we value life and we value children. And then we'll send them to a school where they're serving a diet, which we know leads to cancer, heart disease, stroke, diabetes, osteoporosis, kidney disease, and a whole slew of chronic degenerative diseases over the years. And yet we care for them. So there is a disconnect.
It really is. And that's powerful when you think about it. 70% of 12-year-olds have early signs of heart disease. And it's directly connected to many areas. Children primary meal is inside the schools. In New York City, we serve children two and sometimes three meals a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. They eat unhealthy meals in their schools. They go home to a nutritional, unbalanced meal at home. And you ask yourself, when do they actually get any nutritionally balanced meal? It's unbelievable, but it shows you the resiliency of the human body.
Yeah.
You can almost poison and starve it to death for many years. But that's why doctors know by age 50, you need to have this check. By age 60, you need to have this check, because they know after eating the American diet for 50 years, the body's finally going to break down and it's going to start exposing. And now, because food is so toxic, bodies are breaking down even earlier.
That's right. And you've been involved in promoting healthy school lunches. I did it for decades, promoting school lunches, motivating parents, getting them to work in their schools. And you're involved in similar efforts and at least supporting those efforts.
Yes, we have a great program here in Brooklyn. Meatless Mondays, and we have put in a substantial amount of money in our schools to do hydroponics farming, teaching children how to grow food in the classroom. It is my vision that children would be able to grow their food on the rooftop of their school and serve it in their cafeterias, and also serve and distribute food to the local stores and community groups, senior centers, to really embrace urban farming and show how we can grow healthy food and teach and instruct people how to cook the food, how to make it tasty by using spices. That is our vision, to really change our relationship with food.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. That's a worthy endeavor. We got to get them while they're young. And then you got to get the people who are like us, we're advanced a little bit and we're ready to change. We've got the wisdom to maybe look at it a little bit more deeply.
So true.
Yeah. So racism is something that is the big word these days with what's going on around the world. And when you look at racism, that and speciesism are arguably two manifestations of the same disorder. Both have a starting point of believing that one's race or one's species gives them inherent superiority over another race, another species. While racism is at least outwardly condemned in our society most of the time, and we're reversing a little bit on that here and there, but speciesism is pretty much unrecognized. And as a result, the suffering caused to animals to create meat and dairy products that we have absolutely no biological need for is seen by most, I think most, it's a diminishing number, by most, as nothing to be concerned with. Now, you've done a lot of thinking on both racism and animals and bringing in speciesism. How do you see the connection between those two?
Well, anytime you consider yourself superior over another living being, it's problematic at its core, because all living beings want to have the same things. And, you know, it may seem strange to us because we sometimes are taught differently. But I remember as a child watching my dog give birth to her pups, and the love and nurturing and care that she showed. You can look at any animal show in the wild and see the same relationship that a mother shows for her human child an animal shows for their child, the feeding process, the nurturing, the growing, the tutorial, the teaching, how to survive. It's the same thing. And if you want to define it as the compassion and caring and loving is a characteristic that's only unique to human beings, that's a big mistake. That is not a human trait. That is a being trait, and all living beings share that same trait and same desire.
Absolutely. I saw birds today outside, mother birds and baby birds, and they were being fed and they were starting to fly, and one building a new nest right at our house. And it's just wonderful to see. And I could build a construct where I would believe that they're just doing what they do out of instinct. But really, they're doing exactly what we do. So why wouldn't we believe that they're so doing true. What we do for the same reasons that we do it? It's pretty obvious. Once you open your eyes.
And they do it smarter. They don't put on clothing to suffocate their bodies. You know, they don't put chemicals on their bodies. You know, they don't build machines that would destroy our planet. If we remove them from our existence, we won't survive. If we remove us from their existence, they will flourish and grow and prosper.
Yes, you can make that case indeed. When you were 15, you had a traumatic encounter with police that put you in the position of being powerless in the face of unjust authority. And that experience had a great impact on your life and was actually instrumental in you choosing the direction of your life. Talk a bit about that.
I was 15 years old and I was arrested by the police, and they beat my brother and I in the 103rd precinct, the same location where Sean Bell was shot and killed. Yeah. And the beating was pretty brutal and it angered me. And I think my brother is still going through emotional and psychological trauma because of that. Mm. That was almost 35 years ago, if not even longer, now that I think about it, almost 40 years ago. And it was a life-changing experience for me. And it was my first introduction, without knowing it, to PTSD. Because every time I heard a police siren, I relived that beating. Yeah. Every time I saw a police car, I relived it. Every time I saw a police movie, I relived it. And, you know, those who have examined PTSD, you know that the body doesn't know the difference between you actually going through something or if you're thinking about it. There's still a chemical reaction in your body. And throughout those days, I experienced that. And it wasn't until after another young man was shot and killed in Brooklyn named Randolph Evans that a group of activists that were fighting against police brutality, they told me and 13 of us to go into law enforcement and fight from within. And I was reluctant because, you know, this was the organization that brutalized me. But I had a lot of respect for them, and I joined the police department and became extremely active about making police a fair and just place.
Yep. In fact, you started an organization. Tell us about that.
We started an organization called 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement Who Care. And the goal was really to build a symbiotic relationship between the police and community. We wanted to instruct young people on what they should do when stopped by the police and encourage them to go into law enforcement. We also collected money among ourselves just to help everyday people that were victims of a crime and needed help. And we pushed and advocated for police reform. We were successful in some areas, testifying and on the federal level, and really pushing through how we look at policing in America. And it's so funny, I was laughing today that one of the most draconian acts and laws we had was something called the Rockefeller drug laws. It was extremely punitive to people who had small amounts of any type of drugs. It would put them in prison for a long period of time. And I used, as a cop, I would go and protest at Rockefeller Plaza during the day after I finished my midnight tour with a man named Randy Credico. And then in the evening, I would go back and do my job. Later, when I became a state senator, I was able to co-sponsor the bill that actually repealed the Rockefeller drug laws. And so it was extremely exciting for me to do that, as well as write great legislation around stop and frisk, another punitive tool that was being used or abused, I should say. And so the life as a police officer and retiring as a captain helped me to shape some of the policy, really, to finally get the demon of that beating out of me and realize that I was able to use that painful moment to a purposeful moment.
That's important. That's powerful. And, you know, you look, that was in 1995 that you started that organization, correct?
Yes, it was. It was during the time.
25 years ago. And here we are today dealing with this.
Giuliani was the mayor at the time.
Yeah.
And that's why it brings me so much excitement when I see these young people here today. These young people are really the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren of the civil rights marches that changed how America looked at itself. You know, the winds of change, they have always been blown by young adults. And we should really give them the support they need to allow them to voice themselves. We have to be cautious also, because there is a very dangerous group of people who are attempting to hijack and infiltrate a righteous march by using violence. We don't want that to happen. And I have been communicating with the organizers of the march to tell them how to look out and identify those who are trying to be destructive. And they have done a great job of really ridding themselves and moving the people who are trying to be destructive from their march so people can be focused on what the righteous call is.
Good. Yeah, of course. Everybody knows it's not the protesters who are out there for the right reasons creating this violence. Going to a different aspect of the topic of discrimination, in 2015, there was a study done, and it was published in a journal, Group Processes and Intergroup Relations. And it observed that vegetarians and vegans in Western society, and vegans in particular, experienced discrimination and bias on a par with other minorities, interestingly enough. Now, this is 2015. That was 5 years ago, and a lot has actually blossomed since that time. But as a high-profile person who isn't afraid to call himself vegan, do you feel like you've experienced any kind of that discrimination?
I think we all do. Anytime you sit down at an event and you tell people that, you know, it's okay, I don't eat meat, can I have your vegan menu or plant-based menu, automatically people look over at you and say, you know, what's wrong with you? Oh, you're one of those, you know? So I don't think there's a person who considers themselves vegan or plant-based that has not gone through some form of discrimination for one reason or another. I remember being on a plane and asking the stewardess, you know, that I put in for a vegan meal. And she just got so offended and upset and said, well, you know, you can't eat what they have on the plane.
Wow.
Right. So, but you get that from time to time. But, you want to stay centered and you want to stay balanced. And again, always know the place where people are coming from. And if they only knew what they were doing to themselves and the planet, they would have a different approach. And I think over time, people will evolve to that different approach.
Yeah. Have you found that other people in government are open to hearing some of the benefits and some of the world's changing possibilities that could come from a shift over to that different type of lifestyle?
Well, it's a major paradigm shift. And sometimes a good message needs a good messenger. And because of my transformation, many of my colleagues are starting to second look at this conversation. And the goal is to save animals. It doesn't matter if the goal is carried out. If we're saving animals by saving ourselves in the process, you know, hooray, and eating healthy in the process. And so now we have some good legislation that's being introduced to really deal with the issues that surrounding the overconsumption of meat in our country. And even one of the oldest civil rights organizations in the country, The NAACP put out a resolution calling for plant-based meals in our prisons, in our schools, in our hospitals, and all the places that we feed people. And that's a major shift in philosophy to call by a major civil rights organization calling for a plant-based meal.
That's fantastic. So shifting to the topic of balance, so we don't have much time left. Interestingly, at the beginning of my health and environmental nonprofit advocacy work, I had just come off of a 3-month silent meditation retreat. I'd been doing a lot of it back then. And I've heard you talk about the fact that you also meditate. Talk about how your meditation has benefited your path, how it fits into the whole picture, and how it's connected to perhaps how you look at your diet.
It's so important. And I challenge your listeners to read up on quantum physics and see the power of meditation and how meditation really centers you. You know, anytime you go through a traumatic physical experience, it could disalign your spine, and you, chiropractor can sort of put it back in alignment. Meditation is that spiritual chiropractor that realigns the anatomy of your spirit. It gives you an opportunity to go inward and do real healing in places that we don't see, and silence our mind, give us an opportunity. There's so much noise. We don't really understand the amount of noise and the inability for us to really go inward. And then we live life really troubled by what happened in the past, fearful of what's happening in the future. 50% of our life is in one place or another, that we're never in the present. Meditation allows us not to dread the future or be disappointed about the past. It allows us to be in a place where we only have control of, and that is in our current state. And it brings a level of peace, tranquility, and it gives your body the opportunity to do what it needs to do, and that's heal. Because if we're constantly in the fight and flight stage, where our blood is going to our major organs, then it's never doing the job that it's supposed to do, heal. And meditation allows us the opportunity to heal.
It does indeed. It's kind of like a vacation. It gives you something that you can't really access too much in regular life.
Yes.
And people might think about this. When you go to see a concert and you're in there for a couple of hours, and it could be classical music, it could be anything. But the concert, the music, enjoying the music is great, but there's something else happening there. And that is that you are sitting there with what's going on in your mind and able to let that ruminate and kind of roll through its process and let it go. And it's kind of like a vacation. And it's funny, when I've done a lot of meditation, and people have said to me, you know, I tried and it didn't work. I just kept thinking and thinking. I said, no, that is meditation working.
Yes, it is.
That's happening at every moment of your life. And the thing is, when that thinking that you didn't realize was happening in the first place is happening, you're identifying with that thinking as if it's you.
So true.
And
so
it's keeping true. That continuous repetitive thinking keeps you in a particular state of mind, thinking and being attached to your points of view. So I think the flexibility you're showing in having changed your diet as a result of a life experience that calls for it goes hand in hand with the flexibility of mind that's created by doing something like meditation, where you take moment by moment.
Well said. Well said.
All right. Thank you. Well, that's about all the time we have. I know
thank
you have
you.
To run. I know you've got a lot going on. Any final thoughts you want to leave our listeners with?
Just cycling out of COVID-19 and all of the protests we're seeing all over the globe, there's a lot of anxiety. And I remember on September 11th, 2001, when America received a severe terrorist attack, and we saw the two buildings that were representatives of New York strength collapse. And I went down there that night as a lieutenant, and I saw dust everywhere. The ground was smoldering. People were sitting around, really just overwhelmed. And there was a moment that I thought, what is going to happen to us? And then something happened on 9/12. people got up, teachers taught, retailers opened their stores, and builders built, and the entire country and globe looked at New York City, and we were the epicenter of the attack, and we became that same center of having people know that they could survive. We're here again. We're the epicenter of the COVID-19. We're the center of many of the marches that's taking place. And people may say to themselves that, do we have a tomorrow? I know we do. And if I could borrow from Snapple, we're going to be fine because we're made up of the best stuff on earth. We just got to keep moving forward and endure. We're going to be okay.
Perfect. Thank you so much for that. And thank you so much for all you're doing. It gives us a great sense of peace to know that there is someone like you who's climbing in the ranks. And I understand that there's a possibility of a mayoral running for New York City.
All is in due time.
Okay. All is in due time. All right. Well, thank you again. And thank you for making the time.
Okay. Take care. Great talking to you.
Eric Adams, Brooklyn Borough President. And really someone who's doing things on an institutional level that all of us have thought about doing, but we were not in a position of power to be able to do it. So that's it. We'll come back with The Healthy Planet in just a moment. Stay tuned.
Our climate is changing. Making a few changes to your driving habits can cut tailpipe emissions and improve fuel efficiency. Drive smart. Go easy on the brakes and gas pedal. Get regular tune-ups by following your vehicle's maintenance schedule. Check your tire pressure. Combine as many activities and errands into one trip as possible. Reduce your carbon impact to the environment. Act now on climate change.
A stay in the hospital for people of all ages can be a stressful and challenging experience. But every day, teams of volunteers in UCLA's People Animal Connection, or PAC, make the lives of patients and their families better.
You see the patients get happier and more relaxed. They kind of forget that they're in a hospital bed.
The visits are provided to hospitalized patients without cost. Learn how you can get involved at uclahealth.org/PAC.
This is Bob DiBenedetto back on WUSB 90.1 FM Stony Brook. We just concluded our interview with Eric Adams, the Brooklyn Borough President. And I hope you appreciated that perspective from someone who's in power and not afraid to speak about the immense benefits that can come personally and as a society from switching to a more plant-based diet. And he's gone all the way to a completely whole foods plant-based diet. For the remainder of the show, I'm going to play a clip from another man who is in quite a position of power. In fact, he ran for president. His name is Cory Booker. He also eats a vegan diet. He's not quite as vocal, outspoken about it. He, too, is a Black American, and he has a lifetime experience of dealing with racism. And so this is a short clip of him speaking at the United States Senate in the past few days. United States Senator from New Jersey, Cory Booker.
And I admit I am, like so many other Americans, hurting right now and frustrated right now and feeling a torrent of emotions that I wish I could say was the first time I felt like this. And I want to begin my remarks in a different way because the names that we are hearing shouted on streets, George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, they have like so many other names of people that we did not know. They were not household names. Their names now are mixed into names that we have heard throughout my entire lifetime. But the names and the way we say them mixed with horror and sadness and tragedy, it does not speak to their beauty, their humanity, their fullness, the texturedness of their lives. And the killings of George Floyd, of Breonna Taylor, of Ahmaud Arbery, are singular in their pain, are singular in their particular details, in the anguish and the horror. But this is a terror that is familiar. It is a fear that is baked now, cemented into our culture. For so many Americans, especially Black Americans. This has not just been a tough week, a tough few weeks. It's not just been emotional time because of what we're seeing, the protests all around the country. This has been a tough life. This is the story of day after day after day that punctuates our consciousness only when someone captures on videotape what is a regular part of the fabric of our country. We have a long and wretched and disturbing history in this country of Black people being murdered by law enforcement. Our systems of accountability, our systems of transparency, our ability to end this has proved impotent and feeble. These killings for so many Black Americans today are searing reminders that Black people in this country, as I've heard from dozens of people in my life, as we hear from people on our media, that this could have been me. That this even would have been me in the same circumstances. To hear people at all stations of life, African Americans, saying, I'm alive, but questioning for how long, slipping into savage reality of despair for your life and your safety. To be Black in America is to know that a misunderstanding, that an implicit racial bias, that an interaction that should be everyday and routine can become a moment where your life is turned upside down, where your body becomes broken, or when you are killed. It is a common experience, but this has been a stretch where from bird watching in a park, to jogging in your neighborhood, to going to a corner store, the jarring reminder, reinforced by personal experiences, that it could be you. I was born to two civil rights activist parents, and I was a big kid. I was over 6 feet by the time I was in seventh or eighth grade, and it was a time in my life that is a coming of age for so many people and cultures across our nation, but something began happening to me in that period. It was marked by the fear of my elders, family members who, with jarring personal stories for a preteen or a teen, would tell me what it meant to be Black, to be male in America. They were instilling fear in me as a survival mechanism. They were trying to make me aware of my surroundings. I have difficult memories of trips to the malls with elder Black men in my family and being lectured about what I couldn't do, what I shouldn't do, and what the consequences could be. I remember that talk with my parents where I tried to joke about it, but they got chillingly angry with me about what it meant to have a driver's license in America and what could happen to me. And they told me stories of friends, of family members, of others, and their experiences with the police. I spent from those years of 12 and 13 in an America in the 70s and 80s where the words of my parents and elders, backed up with tragic and terrible stories of their experiences in generations before, were reinforced by my own experiences. Being followed by mall security guards, being accused or stopped, being looked at with suspicion, and experience after experience after experience with police. This cycle of violence in our country, these spasms that jerk us from our comfort and pull us into the world that is faced by so many African Americans, and then we go back. So many of us go back to what is now normal in America, what has been normal in America. This cycle, I hear people now talking about the violence, the rioters. I condemn it in the same way that the other 99 members are. It is awful. It is despicable. It is contrary to the aims of this nation and the movements of our past. but to condemn the violence of those out there doing such awful, destructive, condemnation-worthy actions, but to only condemn them and not to condemn the fullness of that cycle of violence, because there is violence going on even when we don't see it in the streets. Peace even is not just the absence of violence, it's the presence of justice. This unjust cycle in our country that we seem to be stuck in, that makes the names of children like Tamir Rice household names, it is connected with the violence that is pervasive in our nation that demands all of us to speak out against with the same fervor and enthusiasm and energy that people are condemning the violence we're seeing in America today. To fail to do that leaves us in a state of imbalance. To fail to condemn the totality of violence in our country leaves us far from the beloved community we need to somehow find a way out of that cycle. There is violence in our nation, seen in our environment, that we still are a nation where a person's race is the single biggest factor of whether they live near a toxic site or not. Ask a mother of a child who drank lead water for months and months and has had their brain permanently damaged if that was not violence. It's violence to have access to quality care, to not have access to quality care. Ask the woman who's lost her child because she had lack of prenatal care. Ask the black woman in America who today is four times more likely to die herself in childbirth. If this isn't a violence in our society that needs condemnation, it's violence we see from our healthcare system to our criminal justice system to environmental injustice to the denial, as one author says, of inequality in the savage inequalities within our education systems. It's why so many black Americans scream out, "Do you see me? I do not have your equal justice under law. Do you see me? I do not have justice for all. Do you see me? I matter. I matter. Black lives matter. Black bodies matter. America, I love you. Do you see me? Do you know my experiences? Do you see the failings of our ideals?" The murder of a black man by multiple cops who knew they were being filmed in broad daylight is not the extent of the problem of racism in America. It is a final and deadly manifestation of that racism, of a nation where everything about us is interwoven, it is interconnected, we are in relationship with each other. This ideal that we are one nation is not a quaint ideal. It is an inescapable fact of American society. The pain and the hurt of our brothers or sisters is our pain. I can show you that economically. I can show you that by every ideology that's expressed here on the floor of the Senate. This cycle of violence has to stop. The cycle of wretchedness and hurt. Our ancestors scream out at us now. Millions of Americans scream out right now. And I know we have an obligation in this body to do something. I've heard words from people on both sides of the aisle speaking towards the injustice of racism that exists in our country. I've heard words. But for generations, what they sought from this body, greater men and women than any of us, what they sought on the streets, what they sought in front of the White House, from Alice Paul, the first person to protest out there, was legislative changes. That's what they sought.
This is Bob DiBenedetto with the Healthy Planet radio show on 90.1 FM WUSB, Stony Brook. That's all we have for you today. We are certainly in a time of great challenge in this country on so many fronts. Racism, despite the best efforts of some, is still strong. And despite progress, those of color are more likely to be victims of police violence. They're more likely to grow up poor. They're less likely to be promoted, and they're less likely to head corporations. They're more likely to live in communities with pollution of all kinds, from air to water, and they're less likely to have access to healthful foods. As a result, they're at a much higher risk from all the usual culprits, from diabetes to heart disease to asthma, and as we recently saw, are much more likely to die from COVID-19. At the same time, some of our elected officials, and I'm not using the word leaders, have no interest in leading by uniting, but are rather more interested in gaining position by dividing us. They're destroying our environmental and health safeguards as quickly as they possibly can. Instead of taking minimal efforts to address the urgent threat of climate change now, they're choosing to place the burden on future generations who will have to pay dearly to cope with the irreversible damage that they are being born into. On the other hand, we have new rising leaders, including Eric Adams, whose priority is to honestly take responsibility for and address our society's areas of greatest need, protect the health of children, and lead by example, even when it comes to changing their way of eating. And then we have all of us, who are committed to creating a clean, healthy, just world in every way we can, from making sure everything we buy is in alignment with our desire to create the world we know is possible, to making sure we vote when given the opportunity. It's a tug of war right now, and each of us needs to do our part. And on that note, we will end for the evening. My name is again Bob DiBenedetto, and I want to thank you for listening to The Healthy Planet. I'll be with you again next Friday, June 12th, at this same time. That's right, 6 p.m. For more information on any Healthy Planet events or radio shows, or if you're interested in having me do a virtual presentation to your school or group, visit our website at www.healthyplanetusa.org, healthyplanetusa.org, or email us to join our mailing list at info@healthyplanetusa.org. And be sure to like our Facebook page, which is at Healthy Planet USA. And when I'm not here, be sure to listen to Natural Alternatives and the Healthy Planet shows every week at this time, with great hosts sharing cutting-edge health and environmental information, Fridays at 6 p.m. Until next time, stay strong, keep moving even at home. Relax, make your voice heard in this world by speaking up for what's right, even if the political climate is challenging. Be kind to those around you, including our amazing four-legged friends, and enjoy this beautiful world and temporarily cleaner air that we all share. Good night.